Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Welcome to another edition of the El Arpa podcast, and a special welcome to our Alcon listeners, all you judges and lawyers out there. Thank you so much for tuning in. And should we need legal counsel and recourse, we know where to go. Alcorcon.
I'm not sure they want any more work, actually.
Have you ever been there?
I have, yeah.
What do you think of the place?
Lovely. Well, they're not the most charming of places, are they?
It's the edge of Madrid, if you don't know it. Next to Mostel is where Iker Casillas was born. So a bit of a football factory over there.
Well,
they produce one footballer. You know, it's an interesting place because back in the 80s and 90s, it was very industrial, which I guess it still is. But you had a lot of, like, the rave scene back in Madrid was very much centered around the old factories and warehouses of Alcorcón and Mostelés.
How do you know these things?
Because when I was a raver back in the
90s. Oh, yeah. When you were at school.
Yeah, traveled over to Alcorcón, raved my little heart
primary
out.
Primary school trips.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, fair enough.
I don't think it's a huge party scene anymore, is it? Alcorcón, Central.
A huge what scene?
Party scene.
Not as much as any other place that I know, but we should probably ask the judges about this.
How many drug-related cases are they working through?
Yeah, exactly.
Pill popping. that is the rave scene culture. I do quite like it because, not the pills, obviously, Alcorcón, because it's like the edge of the city, so there's a huge expanses of just fields that kind of stretch out into the surroundings of Madrid. You can even see the mountains sometimes.
That sounds like very bucolic. When was the last time you were there?
Like 5 years ago. Oh. Why are they built there? Like CBD, 10,000 skyscrapers?
Nah, I don't think it's changed since in the last 5 years.
No? I do know there's a pirate-themed restaurant in Alcorcón.
Is it?
Yeah. And there's an Opus Dei school situated, ironically, on Avenida Pablo Neruda.
Fair enough. Do you used to work in the pirate restaurant?
I was the greeter. Long John Silver's, I think it's called. So that is Alcorcón. And all you judges and court assistants out there, thank you so much for tuning in. But don't worry, if you are from another region of the world, and I'm talking to you, 2.2% Finland listener, or listeners, get in touch with us. Tell us a little bit about your city or your town or your village or your hamlet. Maybe we'll give it a shout out in the next podcast.
Definitely.
Here's looking at you, Tallinn, East Estonia. So anyway, we have a lot to talk about in part two of the show, but while you're here, we might as well plug our app. If you go to El Arpa Media Podcast, not podcast, El Arpa Media Audio Guide on the Android market, you can download it. Mm-hmm. You can give us a 5-star rating if you want as well, and it is basically audio guides on what? I'll explain it. Okay. Basically, it works like Tinder. So you answer questions about different, like trivia, about different neighborhoods. And if you get correct answers, it matches you with people with the similar or the same correct answers. So not only are you paired off like intellectually, so if you get like 3 out of 5 questions right, you get your equivalent like of your preferred gender. And also you have similar interests because you know a lot or not enough about like Moncloa or the Bernabeu and all that stuff. Is that how it works,
though? Yeah, no? I don't know. You seem to be proficient in the function of those apps. I couldn't tell you.
No, it's just a normal... Okay, since I don't know how it works, can you explain how our app works?
Well, it's very easy. All you have to do is download it and just get listening. You have different neighborhoods and you have audio guides for them. And we also have maps of the area so that you can move around. And well, the maps are offline, so you can actually download it when you have, you know, if you're visiting, you can download it when you have Wi-Fi in the hotel or whatever. And then you can actually use it offline when you're in the street.
So, yes, because I met my friend from Ireland yesterday, Barry Bmeister. So this is a shout out to you, Barry. So all you AlcorCon judges and Barry, hello to you. His phone wasn't working really well because of the data problems. But yeah, if that happens to you, which could happen, like your app will work because it's not based on Wi-Fi. It's already downloaded and the audios are already loaded. Yes. And you can just use it. Whenever you want. So buy now. It's free. So yeah, download now.
We've paid for the maps for you.
So after all this corporate chilling and selling out and plugging so hard, I think we need to have a shower because I feel very dirty with this corporate pushing. Not together separately, obviously. Judging by... What?
Maria. What?
Maria. Oh my God. Okay, so look, this awkwardness has brought part one to an end. We'll join you momentarily for part two, where it'll be cleaner and more intellectually engaged with the topics of interest. Can we do part two without any innuendo? Very unlikely, but this is part two nonetheless, so thank you very much for joining us yet again for this section of the show. How have you been doing? I didn't actually get a chance to ask you, because in part one we're just plugging the app, so how are you actually doing?
I'm very well, thank you. You?
That's good. Yeah, not too bad. You see the thing last night where Roy Keane was having a go at... Well, he wasn't having a go, I think he was making a fair point about just a reality check, English team... progressing but need to do a little bit more. You know, they met a better team, and then Ian Wright's just started taking off his accent and insulting him by pretending to be Irish.
No, I didn't.
No? Well, you haven't seen that, you should definitely YouTube it because it is very bizarre.
That was on BBC?
That was on ITV. Roy Keane and Ian Wright are ITV pundits. But so if an Irish person challenges you, take off their accents, because they really love it when you do it, and it gives you the moral authority in an argument. So, if you haven't seen, I'll show it to you after the podcast.
Okay.
Yeah, because it is, yeah, it is what it is. Not very nice. Nevertheless, though, you have been reading a book I gave you for your birthday. And you know what really makes this podcast easy to record is when I say something and you give me a look where, I don't know, you're not going to say anything, but you're just going to give me a look and just sit there in silence.
No, it's just like I'm saying yes because I know what you're talking about.
Okay.
It doesn't always happen in the podcast.
I send you a memo of what we're going to talk about every week.
Okay. So for example, yes, in this case I know what you're talking about. I'm very nearly finished. I've got like 10 pages left.
I actually have like 10 pages left of the Roy Vallecano book as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Good.
So we have some synchronicity. So this book is interesting. What's the title?
The title is I Will Be the Last One.
Okay.
The title, yes. It's about, the Iraqi conflict, basically.
Okay.
The last one. And it's about a girl who is part of a tribe called Yazidi. I'm not quite sure how you pronounce it. I suppose it's like that in English.
Any Yazidi lawyers out there? Please get in touch and teach us the pronunciation of Yazidi. Please continue, Maria.
And yes, and it's very interesting because I knew nothing about this tribe, and it turns out that it comes from a very small place. It's pretty much in just a very reduced area. And she explains at the beginning what they believe, that they believe in, you know, a kind of like angel that acts as a god, and well, they don't have a book. They just have like these ancestral traditions, like oral tradition, and well, it's just a very different religion, and they speak Kurdish.
Kurdish, yeah, okay.
But they are not Kurds, you know. They are a different ethnicity.
Do they explain the book? Was there a point in history where they were one unit or one group and then they diverge for some political reason?
They don't really go very much into those details, to be honest. She talks about how they are settled in that area from the 1950s. But she doesn't explain much about the history. I
Okay.
suppose because she has, I don't know, she has so much to say about what happens afterwards. And her focus is like the genocide of these people, so.
Okay, so who is responsible for this?
The Islamic State.
Okay, so it's a story of ISIS.
Yeah.
And did they have a ISIS obviously had a very particular bone to pick with the West when they're in countries like Iraq. Obviously they assert their power through violence when they take over regions and when they're establishing their so-called Islamic State. But is there anything in the book that indicates that they had a specific grievance against this group of people?
Well, I mean, they had a grievance against anybody who wasn't, well, who wasn't a Muslim, what they considered to be a Muslim, which obviously wasn't like the norm. But they had an issue specifically with these people because, as far as they knew, because they didn't follow a book. Like, it wasn't, for example, like the Christians that also have the Bible. So, like, you know, what are called like people of the book, like Christianity and
Yes.
Judaism and Islam. And these people, obviously, as I've said, they don't have a book. So for them, it was like they were even like worse, and they weren't even human for them. They treated them like animals. And this is how they turn most of the women into like sexual slaves.
Yeah. Now, there's a few questions I can ask you, but first of all, the foreword is written by a very famous person who is George Clooney's wife. What's her name again?
Amal Clooney.
Emma Clooney. I knew it was Clooney, so
Yeah, well, okay, but yeah, she's married to George Clooney now, but
I
she
know she has
wasn't.
her own life and career, and she's not amazing because she's married to George Clooney. She just happens to be married to George Clooney, but I just couldn't remember her name. There. Okay.
I
So,
know that.
I like. In the media, I guess it hasn't been covered in great detail, their specific suffering. But in terms of the United Nations and her advocacy for this group, are there charities working specifically with this ethnic group, or what's their status and who are they working with, or who's working with them?
Well, she actually started her own charity. Well, there was a charity that was already running when she managed to escape, you know, her captors or her owners, basically, because she's sold from one person to another. And then when she manages to escape, so she manages to escape. She joins like a group that was already starting to help rescue girls from human trafficking, which is called YASDA, is the organization, and she becomes very active there. And then also she creates her own charity to help girls who are victims of human trafficking across the world. Which is called Nadia's initiative because she's called Nadia.
Okay, so I've obviously ISIS has been in the newspapers, but specifically what's happened after the collapse of the ISIS state, and there's so many issues here, reintegration of former ISIS fighters, different countries and their laws surrounding them. I think we mentioned in the previous podcast that in Sweden, for example, they don't have any law to arrest them, which might change might have changed already. Also, there's BBC have done great podcasts about this, where you have orphanages run by local women in Iraq. Though I think actually this was actually in Afghanistan. And basically, the reaction of people who were victims of ISIS when they're in power, and they're kind of giving out to her for looking after these children, because some of these children are the kids of ISIS brides, and some of these women were either coerced into it or joined voluntarily by traveling from another country, for example. Also, the BBC podcasts have gone to, they've interviewed mothers of ISIS fighters. 50% of ISIS fighters who went over there have been killed or are missing. And again, reintegrating them into society is very, very difficult. in terms of this ethnic group in this area in Iraq, what's it like? Does she go into the great detail about the post-conflict reconstruction of society, you know, roadblocks that charities might be encountering in terms of attitudes towards people that may or may not have had contact with ISIS?
Well, I suppose this is what is being explained at the very end.
Yeah.
I must admit, she spends most of the book talking about like what actually happened to her and the processes and how it works, how it worked. Which, to be honest, it's a very valuable story because it's not well known, and she gives a lot of details about the reality of it. But then at the end, she very quickly talks about when she goes back, about this, how she's first and foremost, she's really worried that her own family are going to reject her because, well, for the Yazidis, like for many other ethnic groups, you cannot have sexual relations outside marriage, and she's not married when she leaves. So she just thinks that when she gets back, they might just
denounce her.
Yeah. But they don't actually. They are quite understanding, although she makes a point of not explaining everything that happened to her in much detail.
Okay. And in terms of picking up the pieces after these horrible events, in other documentaries you've seen people going back to their home after it's been destroyed and or it had been occupied by an ISIS division or an ISIS commander, for example. So her family maintained their home. But was there any scene? Well, yes, they maintained their home.
Well, she went back to her aunts because actually, like, some of her brothers survived, but some of them were killed because basically this was the biggest part of the genocide when the Islamic State entered Kocho, which is the place where they lived. They killed most of the men. Like the only ones that survived was because they played dead or they managed to escape like that.
So basically, as well, other accounts have given insight. I think it was in The Guardian that they ran a series of how the ISIS state actually operated. Does she talk about that in the book as well? How they collected taxes and how they imposed their political and financial will upon the local people, or not really, you know?
Not so much. To be honest, it's more focused on like exactly like what happens to her, the dynamics of like human trafficking. It doesn't focus very much on the other aspects.
Okay, so it's more a human trafficking story. So
yes,
does this plug into, you know, for example, a lot of African girls, Nigerian girls, are being trafficked from Africa into Europe. They're being told the story. They're being lied to, and then they're at great risk of being forced into prostitution. Mm. So, you know, given her, in some sense, very specific situation, you know, dealing with ISIS, and this was a very unique threat in a way, is there a lot of similarities, do you think, with her story and her account of sexual trafficking and other ones that have been happening around the world for such a long time and that were in existence before the arrival of ISIS?
Well, it's interesting because towards the end of the book, she talks about how she gets to know some women from Rwanda who suffer the same as she did. And she makes a remark that when she was little, she had no idea, or she grew up most of her life having no idea there was such a country.
Yeah.
And then she, later on in her life, when she starts being like an ambassador, then she meets these people and sort of feels like the need to help women in general rather than, you know, be so focused on her particular conflict.
Has she gone into how she's going to maybe raise awareness more about this, you know?
Well, and the main thing that she wants to happen is for people to be, people who are responsible to be made accountable. And for that, what she does is like she takes it to the Court of Human Rights. And, well, I think what she realizes is that, as you said, this is a problem in all conflicts across the world. So I think apart from like her personal, it's not really a vendetta because she's
her personal quest. Or
something. Yeah. Apart from that, she really wants the world to, you know, to know what they've done and like held them accountable. And I think that's just an example that if that moves forward and if that actually happens, then because it's like a court of human rights, it will set like a precedent for the whole world.
And going back to a point that we briefly raised earlier in the podcast, surely there have been kids produced as a result of this, no? In her community or people that she's been close to or was encapped or, you know,
captive. I suppose so, but she doesn't really mention anything about that.
Because that seems like a very significant detail because, again, in other accounts that have dealt with this, there's a real worry that, well, you know, once they're of age, they might learn what their father did or what their mother did and might be susceptible to being pulled back into this kind of environment. Well, that might not happen, of course, because they might learn about it and be appalled by it, or maybe they'll never hear about it until they're very old, or never, like they'll never hear it. But it's something that in the future has to be faced. So I don't know. Is there a reason for this exclusion from the book, do you think?
Well, I think that it's mostly to do with her culture. Like in her culture, like, you know, it's all, well, probably in any culture, but in her culture even more, like it's all very like shameful and, you know, she doesn't give very many details. She doesn't mention any kids or anything like that. And she doesn't give details, specific details about sexual encounters or anything like that, which like in other accounts that I've read about other situations, like for example, about when the Russians invaded Germany, you know, the Second World War.
Yeah, rape was very rampant there, yeah.
Yeah, and the person giving this account was like far more specific about the dynamics of that. She hasn't really mentioned any specifics or anything to do with children.
Okay, so obviously she's very courageous. That's not in doubt, of course. It's a story that has to be told, and she's doing a lot of great work. But do you think that some of the misinformation, and I don't mean specifically the encounters themselves, but perhaps the utter self-editing wherever it occurs in the story, does that, do you think, weaken the story overall? And I'm talking in a pure narrative sense. Obviously the message and the woman behind it, you know, can't be faulted, but in terms of telling the story, is there something that you feel is impacted by the missing information or what could appear to be missing information?
That's a very good thing to remark, because I was thinking about that last night when I was reaching the end of the book, that there's like a naivety to her, which is, you know, nice, whatever you can class it as. But I believe it makes her miss out on a lot of, surrounding information, you know, not about like, you know, gruesome details or anything like that, but like you said about, the consequences of what happens to these people and, all these like collateral things that
I guess,
have to be considered.
I guess there's, you know, because I remember when I joined Amnesty International in my university, actually one of the first things we organized that year was a debate on sexual trafficking in Ireland and how Ireland needed to tighten its rules to protect women and to stop it happening, basically, because, you know, I mean, I guess every country is a destination point for these women. But I guess her story, and you've read it and I haven't, is very Amnesty International in the sense that it's about bearing witness and there's space for other accounts or contextualized accounts, and hers is a raw, personal, and who she is and the experience that she lived being the person that she is. And that form and structure story has inevitable drawbacks because of its very structure, but also its plus points are very impactful because it's a story lived and being recounted by the person in the midst of it. So I, more or less, I guess the question is that the pluses of the book far outweigh any possible gaps, no? Or,
yeah, yeah, no, I think it's very interesting that you say that, because actually when you're when she escapes and then she starts talking about how she's the first one to return, and then she talks about all the people in her family and her friends returning, managing to escape later on, and then obviously she gives like glimpses of their personality, and you're almost like left wanting that they told the story too, you know, from their point of view and with their personality.
Well, here's the thing, because you mentioned World War II, and you know, the person that counts from anything really, and even though it is very compelling, they become famous. I mean, for example, Anne Frank, you know, I told an incredible story. Now she's a byword for personal accounts during great times of crises. But again, there's, you know, 6 million other stories that we haven't necessarily heard. In terms of the Jewish experience in the Second World War, for example. So again, even though it's incredible her story is, you're right, there is a sense that, well, obviously other people have suffered this as well, and there's so many stories that haven't been told yet, and might never be told. So her account is very valuable for that as well, because it is one story that has seen the light of day, and it can represent all those other people who haven't had the chance yet, or who may never have the chance to tell that story. Yeah. And how old is she?
She's actually like only like 25 or something like that. She's actually really young.
Well, that's the thing as well. I mean, in her role, I think she's probably going to be on this circuit for the rest of her life, no, as an ambassador. So she might revisit this and tell it in different ways, and maybe extract stories from other people as well. Then.
Yeah.
So I think it's a story that's going to keep unfolding in many ways. So inevitably, of course, you will recommend this book, no, to people.
Yeah, of course, because, you know, it's just a side of a conflict that, well, it's not as if we know tons about it, but we're far more familiar with, you know, things like the Taliban and the atrocities that they committed. But then, and for example, the Kurds, so, you know, we know that but a genocide from San Hussein, but then these people are kind of like even like below the Kurds, which is like an unimaginable level.
It's incredible with the Kurds, because like if you ever go into it, like, you know, a Turkish restaurant is a brand, you know, but a lot of people who are running them or are working them are actually Kurds, for example. Just don't worry, this is a point. Irish bars are a brand as well, or Chinese restaurants might be, or Indian restaurants might be owned by Bangladeshis, but I think if you're an Irish person, you actually have a bit of a relationship with Kurdish people, because they find out that you're Irish, they always tell you that they're Kurds, while with other people they just say they're Iraqi or something like that, or they from a territory at large. But with us, they've always said, well, we're Kurds, because then they understand that we kind of get their political situation as well. So it's interesting. Also as well, obviously the beheadings or gruesome videos are going to be, you know, good copy to you, for lack of a better phrase, for a newspaper, for a rolling news station. But you know, again, these are her things she suffered are ongoing problems that we have in the world and in society that don't get as much coverage because they're so familiar, unfortunately. So again, it's a nice reminder, or it's a important reminder that these things haven't gone away. And there's more to ISIS cruelty than the attention-grabbing, headline-dominating beheadings that have been a feature of ISIS propaganda. So yeah, so it seems like a very interesting book. So this has been quite a heavy part, so we'll leave you with a little bit of music, and we'll come back in just a moment, still in part two, to talk about other things of culture, and then we'll lead you directly into part three. Okay, so we hope you enjoyed that little musical interlude. So, you know, we were joking in part one, and we've actually already recorded part three. And we're going to be joking in that. So just because we're joking now and in those parts, you know, doesn't detract from, you know, our sincerity when we're talking about serious things like we were doing in the first part of part two. So if it seems like a bit of a juxtaposition or a bit of a dissonance in tone, you know, I think you know, the old adage is if you go to a funeral, you're going to see someone laughing, you know, if you take a so just because we're joking now doesn't mean that we weren't sincere or passionate about what we're talking about when we're referring to that book. So just to make that clear. I don't know about Leon, but we have a fierce streak of black humour anyway in Ireland, given our own tragic past. And Ian Wright, F you for taking off an Irish accent, you big clown, yeah. Anyway, so speaking of Irish culture...
You're going to have to show me that.
I will actually, yeah. Because that's so common, by the way. It's actually genuinely actually very annoying. And... There's so much more I can say about that, but I don't want to get really into it. But if you ever want to know why the average Irish person maybe doesn't want England to do well in the World Cup, it's not because of anti-Englishness, because it's not, but it's because, you know, there's so many... there's so many examples of that kind of rubbish. And I'm going to stop talking about it because the laughter is going to stop and I'm going to get genuinely angry about it. So, but speaking of Irish culture... Irish dancing, tiddly. So you've found a group.
Yes.
So while I nurse my grievance of past wrongs, can you explain to our listeners what you know, who these people are and what we're going to be doing with them?
It's a dancing group, and basically I thought they were Irish in Madrid, but they're not. They're all Spanish, but they just love Irish dancing and Irish culture. So they just they have like shows where they show different types of like Irish dancing through history.
Okay.
And well, since we are slightly interested in Ireland, I think.
Very much, yes. Or slightly, yes.
Yeah. I thought, you know, well, we share the same interest, so we thought it would be interesting to contact them and have a little interview with them.
Yeah, we're going to interview them, and also...
And they agreed, so that's
great.
Fantastic.
We're going to start a blog as well in August about Irish things in Madrid, and it's going to be part of a long-term project. We'll reveal more as we go along sobre la marcha. And also, if you want to see our previous dancing video, we did one in December of last year. With some belly dancing.
Oh, I thought we were talking about the video where you do some mean moves at the beginning.
No, I'm talking about the belly dancing. So if you want to see some, but if you want to see some belly dancing, check out our YouTube channel.
Yeah.
And you'll find it under a video called Shimmer.
Yeah,
and,
that's right.
And also involves Indian culture. In terms of Bollywood dancing as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a mix of things there. And it's also an act of charity because it was a dance performed in an old folks' home. And there's one woman there with Alzheimer's who kept telling me her husband was dead. So they're nice people.
The joys of visiting old people's home.
Yeah, it was a nice experience, but also kind of sad for obvious reasons. But yes, that's going to be a big project. Speaking of Irish things as well, my friend Barry,
Irish things.
Irish people.
Have you just called him a thing?
I've objectified him somehow. But he's a subscriber now. I made him subscribe yesterday to the podcast. So if you are listening to this by any chance, but I doubt you are because you actually are mad cool. So you might be hearing this next week, but then if it's next week, you might be listening to next week's episode. So you might never hear this. And things are falling in the studio here. It's a bit of a hazardous work environment.
Why does everything hit me in the head?
Because I don't know.
Okay, well, hi Barry. No.
Hi Barry, thank you very much. But it was really great talking to him about filming, cameras, cinema, buffs, and otherwise. Because he's like saying, like, there's this director who's 31 who's made a movie which is in the cinemas now. And it's a horror movie with that Australian girl who's in Muriel's Wedding and about a boy, Tony Collette.
Oh, yeah.
Hereditary, is that the name of the movie?
Oh, it could be, yeah, something like that. I've seen the poster, sorry.
He said like when he was 14, he was like watching Bergman and Truffaut and like 6-hour obscure TV movies. And Christopher Nolan, well, like, and Barry's like saying he couldn't really identify with that, because, like, you know, and Christopher Nolan, who's the Batman director, and of Inception fame as well, said like, when, like, look, a lot of directors, when I say they were introduced to cinema by Fellini when they were like six, but you know, most of us got involved with cinema like you know, watching Star Wars or something like that. So for like a lot of modern directors, Star Wars was the entry point for them into the world of cinema. Now obviously as you get older your tastes change. And I actually was making fun of him yesterday because I remember him taking us for his birthday party to see the movie Volcano with Tommy Lee Jones. I think in the year that Seven was released. So you know, if you know, we should have been watching classic movies from an early age. And also he owned a video store in our local town, so you know, plenty of big ways for him to see classic movies. But all's burned. And what are you missing, man, if you're listening? So but I think it's an interesting point because I think there is a tendency, we can talk about this in another podcast, but there's a real snobbery in cinema as well, or in any kind of art scene. And I know people who kind of look down on certain types of movies. I know people who look down on Richard Linklater because he's not gritty enough, but if you go out on a sunny day like this and you look around, it's not necessarily gritty. So I think you have to capture all aspects of life as well. So I think, you know, it's a very strange philosophy to have. Also as well, you know, like, you know, you have big budget popcorn movies, but for example, the movie I've seen the most is Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, and I think there's so much you can kind of pick apart about that movie as well in terms of how, you know, like in a lot of superhero movies, of which of course Indiana Jones is not one, you have a real trope now where you have a huge light in the sky and either aliens come out of it or go into it. But like, you know, and they had their kind of their beats, but Indiana Jones is kind of different because it's kind of based on a spirituality that isn't really featured in movies. And it's not like a religious movie, but I'm just trying to say that it approaches this kind of like overarching power in a different way, and maybe intrinsically in a human way, for example, because a lot of movies, especially superhero movies, deal with that. And that's, you know, so I think you can kind of analyze even different movies like that and unpick kind of certain things, that why they appeal and why they don't. And of course it's a 50s serial, or that's, it was based on kind of 50s B movies, so again you're kind of going into archetypes and common characters that we have in traditional mythological stories. So you know, even though on first glance it could be, or you could dismiss something as a event movie or whatever, I think you could still learn a lot cinematically and even with characterization, because again that movie also balances action, romance and comedy quite well, I think, from movies like that as well. So if you want to learn from cinema, and we can do another podcast about this on another day, I think you should be consuming everything, and you shouldn't be, you know, turning up your nose at certain genres or certain things like that. But then again, some people don't watch movies to grow. They watch movies so they can tell other people that they've watched them. So that is all from us in part two. A little bit of music, and we'll be talking to you very soon in part three. So, refreshed, showered, this is part three. Thank you so much for listening to part one and part two. We are going to get our t-shirts today. So, t-shirt lady, explain the t-shirts.
Well, the t-shirts are just the t-shirts that we're going to wear when we're doing the tour of Lavapiés, which is the first one of our tours of Barrios. They kind of fall, well, it's a different way, you know. If you want to do your own thing, you can listen to the audio guides. But if you want to, I'm getting an evil eye because I'm making noise with my feet.
No, I actually wasn't listening. I was just distracted there. Sorry.
Okay, so if you want to, you know, just join the tour with us and just have a fun, you're making me.
A fun trip. Well, it's just, I just think about the t-shirts because basically, for some reason, it's insanely difficult to print on both sides of the t-shirt. And also,
it's not insanely difficult, it's just expensive.
And who knew there were so many greens? You had like wasabi green, yerba green, green lantern green, marijuana green, gone off meat in a bin bag green. lots of options. Well, to be honest with you, the t-shirts that were on display didn't look amazing, but I have high hopes that our t-shirts are going to look nice. I wouldn't mind either a collar or like a slight v-neck in the t-shirt.
V-neck?
But what we have...
Look, like we're paying at dinner, you're not going to get a v-neck.
A tenner each. Yeah, you negotiated so hard. You got us a €2 discount on the two t-shirts. I was so proud of you.
Well, I did my best. What can you do?
Think Alec Baldwin, Glengarry Glen Ross levels of negotiation. You gave a real take it or leave it. He said, okay, I'll leave it. And then you said, okay, we'll take it. So a classic take it or leave it strategy.
Well, it's better than nothing.
So, since we've built it up so much, if you want to see what they look like, we're going to collect them after we finish this podcast. And after you finish listening to this Radio Public advert, which you should hear because this podcast will be longer than 30 minutes and we've already started out the ads, you can go to our Instagram, LARPA Media. No, it's just LARPA is on Instagram. So you can see us in those t-shirts, and also you can follow us on LARPA 1 on Twitter, YouTube, Patreon, LARPA Media are our handles on both those platforms. You can support us financially on Patreon if you want. If you don't, no problem either. So that's our big news with the t-shirts. I don't know. Like, it just, what else is there? There's nothing else. I think we've spoken about everything.
This is part three.
This is part three, yeah. This is where we plug all that stuff, so.
I think that's all.
Okay, so join us next week for another illuminating podcast. Next week, which should be released on Thursday. And if you're a judge in another city that isn't AkerCon,
give us a shout.
Give us a shout. And you know what? The law rocks. The Alarpa Podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.